Hello and welcome to episode 414 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Ben Olson. With me is Nathan Fox. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. Today we have a special guest, Cici Xie. Did I say that right?
Very close. It's Xie.
Xie. Okay. Thanks so much for joining us. If you have questions or you want to share news with us, you can do so on our website. That's thinkinglsat.com. Just a quick announcement, coming up Wednesday, August 9th at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, we have a pre-test pump up with Chris. You can sign up for that at lsat.link/free. Anything you want to add to that, Nathan?
No, let's talk to Cici.
Okay. So Cici, you describe yourself as a writer, a lawyer, a content creator, and a lot of other things. You got your BA in economics from Yale, your JD from Harvard. You went on to work at a big law firm. Which firm were you at?
I was at Simpson Thacher at first and then MoFo.
Okay, got it. And you worked there for some time, right? You eventually became a senior associate.
Yeah, and, I was a sixth year.
Okay. And started a TikTok. I don't even know what it's called. Is it a channel? What do they call it?
Maybe just an account.
A TikTok account. Okay. Yeah. Well, during COVID or something like that, right? And then that took off and your firm was okay with that. And and then eventually you decided to leave. And that's where we are now, right? How long ago was that? Sorry.
That was about like a year and a half ago. I left in March of last year, so 2022.
Okay. And you left, from what I understand, to write a book about being a big law attorney. Is that right?
Yes. Well, more partially an investigation of big law more generally, but then also with my own experiences.
Okay. What else do you want to add to that introduction? That's all I know. What else should our listeners know?
That's pretty good. I feel like other things that kind of play into my weird career is that I was a K through JD. So I had absolutely no idea what I was doing with my life when I applied to law school. And I really do think it's only due to a lot of luck and privilege that I have even been able to kind of create the life that I have today. And it's, I'd say, you know, the one thing, if I've learned anything, is to lean into the changes of life. And I do think especially those who become lawyers, those who go into big law, are drawn towards the rules of life and kind of this like blueprint or conveyor path. And I feel like the more you get comfortable with moving away from that, the more exciting and more fulfilling you'll find your career to be.
Yeah, I think, well, I went to law school with all the intents of becoming an attorney of some sort. I actually don't know what my plan was, but ended up working for a professor at my law school who did legal writing consulting for all the big firms in the world. And instead of going into legal practice, started working for him after law school. And he was teaching classes all the time, which then motivated me to start teaching the LSAT as my own thing on the side. And then eventually that took off and, you know, never would have predicted that outcome, but I can definitely see that. Cool. Anything else?
Oh man, what's relevant here? Maybe that I just recently started a law firm again with one of my friends. So I thought I would be totally out of legal practice, and it's like gravity sometimes pulls you back in. And I also teach an intellectual property course at Yale, which has been really fun. And I totally understand like loving the feeling of teaching and like the feeling of explaining things to people. And I feel like it's almost just empowering them to live the life that they want and to understand more about the world. And that's really what I love about all of this, even about legal work, right, is helping people understand the world around them.
Yeah, it's interesting that you got pulled back in. What prompted that?
Yeah, again, leaning into the vicissitudes of life, right? So I really hadn't thought about practicing law again, but through all of my content creator activities, I ended up meeting another content creator whom I had loved for ages. And she'd posted about some copyright issue. And I ended up meeting her at a party. And I was like, I just wanted to find out how the copyright issue was going. And I kind of told her what I thought. My like, you know, not legal advice, general legal thoughts. And at the end of that conversation, she was like, oh my gosh, like, you know, I hire a big law firm right now, but I'd kind of like to hire you. And that was a moment where I was like, oh, but I don't have a firm. I have no practice. I don't have malpractice insurance. I just like hadn't thought about it at all. But I really enjoyed the issues that she was facing. They're kind of the same issues that I actually teach in my copyright and like intellectual property course. So I was like, oh man, I'd be almost like stupid to not work on these issues because they're part of the reason that I went to law school in the first place. So I was like, you know what? I will set up an entity to practice from and figure it out, because I do think leaning into the things that excite you and the questions that get you motivated to thinking about stuff, like that's what life is all about.
How did your family react to you quitting your big law job?
You know, weirdly, kind of mixed. My dad, he was like, you know, I kind of always thought that you might leave, but I thought it'd be after you had a house. And I think in this economy, I was like, really? Really? My mom was a bit more like, well, you spend so much time working that if you don't feel 100%, you know, 150% passionate about it, and there's something else you would like to do, that's something that you should pursue. She's had her own career pivots throughout, so I think she was a bit more understanding about it. But it was, yeah, it was kind of mixed. I mean, my parents are immigrants, so I think they both understand the pull of wanting stability and the pull of that income and lifestyle, but also on some level are like, oh, well, we left China to have a better life and have a happier life, so it's almost stupid to tie you to something if it's not making you feel fulfilled.
Are they excited about you getting back into law?
No. Well, it's not like a really big thing.
Yeah, because you're big law salary type of a thing. You're just going to have your own practice. They're probably a little skeptical for now.
I think they're like skeptical in the same way that they're skeptical about all of my other endeavors, right? I think about writing, it's like, they're like, oh, okay, that's nice, but can you make a career out of it? And everything else I do, they're like, oh, that's nice, but where does it all go? And I think that's a valid question that I also ask myself every day. But I, you know, at some point, you just got to believe in yourself. And I think that's something that a lot of lawyers, especially big law lawyers I speak with, they have a hard time doing. They have a hard time believing in themselves, even though it's themselves that got them so far in the first place.
It got them so far within that structure that you were talking about earlier, right?
Yes.
But maybe not outside of that structure. And that's where they feel uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, and it's not even saying that they might not go far. They just don't try.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. So you were working at MoFo, then you left and, you know, working for a big law firm. I've never done that, but we've certainly heard a lot about it. And I have friends who do. And it's a full on commitment. But now you're creating your own law firm. You can set it up however you want. So what's your day to day like?
Honestly, up until my book delivery date, which will be in like March or April of next year, I'm really keeping the legal practice low key. I kind of just want to have that one client, work on that one matter, turn down everything else. In terms of what I really love to do, like if I could just write full time, I would absolutely do it. So a lot of my days now are, you know, I wake up, I work out, I do a writing exercise, and then I just do a lot of reading and thinking. I have the next like 6 months planned, and it's just a lot of writing and thinking about this book because I finally got paid with my book advance. And the thought of having to give that back is horrifying. So I'm locked in now.
How did you get an agent?
Yeah. So through my content creator endeavors, I kind of started meeting other content creators. And one of them, she was also a big law partner who became a content creator and then took a step back from partnership. I was talking to her and I was telling her that I had some book ideas, always wanted to write. But when I was younger, again, my parents were like, what are you going to do with an English degree? Be poor forever. So I never ended up meaningfully pursuing that. But when I told this to my content creator friend, she was like, oh, well, I can introduce you to my lit agent. He's great. So I met him, signed with him. And every month I would send him an email basically saying, I am so sorry, but I haven't had time to work on this. And that kind of reached a boiling point where I was like, why am I putting off this thing that I really want to do, have wanted to do since I was, you know, 8? And I can't do it. I can't spend any time on it. So that led to an inflection point in my career where I was like, you know, I'm a 6th-year associate. I could probably take a year off anyway. So let me just throw myself into this other thing and see where it goes.
Did you write a proposal to sell your book?
Yes. Yeah. So I worked on a proposal. It was like, I don't know, 4.5 months. My first draft was horrible. By the end, it got pretty good. And my editor actually also had watched my TikTok. So when she found out I was putting together a proposal, she reached out and was like, I'm really interested in your book. And after I submitted, it sold. And that's kind of where I am now, in this like weird no man's land of not being sure what happens next, but also being very excited about what has happened already.
How did you connect to, you said your editor, is that not an editor at the publishing house?
It is an editor at the publishing house. Yes.
How did you know them before actually selling the book?
She watched my content on social media and proactively reached out. Yeah. I think it's really, in general, I find some lawyers, especially big law lawyers, to be very reticent about any type of promotion or marketing, right? But, and I was the same way. I was just like, well, I don't want a public persona. What am I going to do with it? But now after seeing the opportunities that one gets from just like being a little bit more public, a little leaning more into marketing, but of course, in a way that makes sense to you, right? I think in general, we shy away from things like networking and sales because we find it cringy. But there is a way to do all this that makes sense for you and that also lets you reap a lot of benefits and opportunities that you otherwise wouldn't have.
So tell us about the book.
Yeah. So it will be part memoir and part reporting. I've interviewed more than, 60 big law attorneys about their experiences in big law. And I think what really inspired the book is, you know, as an associate, you talk to so many of your friends, so many of your coworkers, and they have all these crazy stories. And it got me thinking, like, why doesn't anyone tell these stories? There haven't been a lot of books, nonfiction books about big law, even though there have been a lot of like tell-alls, exposés in finance, tech, really a lot of other industries, except for big law. And I was like, that's weird. Like, are we just all so scared that we can't talk about it? And I thought maybe I could provide, so I was partially a privacy lawyer, so I think about how to anonymize, how to de-identify to the best of your capabilities. And one of the ways that, you know, companies do it is by amassing data, is by like kind of doing composites and putting it all together. So I was thinking, oh, well, this is a good opportunity. I probably can talk to so many people and make sure that everyone's stories get told, but in a way that minimizes blowback to them. And then we can actually start to have a serious conversation about the realities of big law, about how big law plays into our corporate systems and the rest of the world, and not just write novels about it and then just have the big law firms be like, oh, well, that's fiction. That's fiction. Because we love fiction stories about big law, right? We love the TV shows. We love the novels. We do not have many nonfiction books about the same.
Cool. You have a title?
It's tentatively Big Bad Law, but I do not know if we're going to keep it. I think the publisher has to like run their own tests, blah, blah, blah. So subject to change. But that's what I liked, because I was like, oh, it's like Big Law, but also Big Bad Wolf. And I wanted to kind of evoke that sense of quiet sinisterism.
Yeah. Cool. I like it. Publishing date?
I think it's tentatively April or May 2025. So the spring after the election, which was really important because my publisher was like, yeah, we're not doing anything during the election.
Huh. Oh, that's really like far off date. For the book is done, right?
No, I'm writing it now.
Oh, you're writing it right now. Oh, okay.
Yeah. I sold it on proposal. So it means I basically just created a pitch deck for the book and then that was sold. And then I kind of get an advance to help me with costs and living while I write the book. And then it will, you know, then it will publish. So the nonfiction publishing process is a lot longer than the fiction publishing process, which usually it's already done when you try to shop it out.
They got to do all sorts of fact checking and so forth.
Yeah, although I think I have to pay for my own fact checker. So that's part of it. I think they do the copy editing.
Okay.
Is that a standard thing in book publishing to, excuse me, to not do anything during the election?
I don't think it's standard. I think it's just whether you think your book would be interesting to the demographic that would be paying a lot of attention to the election during that same time. And as my publisher explained it, you know, in terms of promotion, we'll try to get podcast spots, you know, news shows. And during that time, it is more likely that you'll get bumped from the listing for something because of something that happens with the election, which totally makes sense.
So put the book out in a slower news cycle, sort of. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I also think it's a good, you know, pre-summer associate internship book / like graduation present. So in the same way that I think 1L, we still talk about that book, 1L is so formative for the first year of law school. I'm like, we don't have anything explaining the first year of being an associate at a big law firm, which is kind of funny.
I mean, we still recommend that people read 1L. You know, all of our LSAT students were like, hey, if you're serious about this, at the very least, you could read this. You know, it's if nothing else, take it as just a devil's advocate, see the other argument and read why, you know, somebody so strongly thinks that you shouldn't probably not go. Or also we say we require people kind of to read Don't Go to Law School Unless. That's actually the book that I was thinking of more than 1L. But Don't Go to Law School Unless, just to like, hey, why don't you see this other side? I could definitely see us recommending Big Bad Law in the same way where it's like, oh, really? You think you want to go into big law? Okay, cool. Well, at the very least, take a look at Cece's book and see what you think.
Yeah. I mean, I think all of these institutions, right, there's a time and place for them. And if you go into them eyes wide open, then fine. But I do think a lot of people go into law and big law with eyes wide shut. And that's kind of due to just the reputational value that being a lawyer has in our society.
Yeah. And the starting salary, right? People coming out of college, they hear these starting salaries, which just seem unreal to them. And they go, yep, that's what I want to do. I don't care what, you know, what it takes. But we have many people who are obviously listening to the show to get better at the LSAT to go to law school. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those people want to go into big law. Mm-hmm. What would you say to them?
I think the number one thing to know about big law is that during the recruiting process, career services will not have your best interests at heart. During the summer, the firm will not have your best interests at heart. And when you start as an associate, the firm will not have your best interests at heart. So I think oftentimes, you know, career services is always like, oh, yeah, we're here to help you. We're here to help you, like, get the most out of your career. But they're going to advise you to go to a firm that is better for them. And same thing for the firm. I can't tell you how many times recruiting or big law firms will say to summer associates, yeah, you know, you can try everything during the summer. And that's true. You can try everything. It's just not good for you to not focus on, you know, maybe 2 to 3 practice areas that you really want to do. I think how expensive junior associates have gotten, there's a lot less exploration now and a lot less opportunities for exploring different practice areas when you're an associate. So you have to really make sure that you're advocating yourself for yourself from the get-go rather than just trying to fit in where the firm has needs. I guess here's an example I learned from some of my interviewees for my book. During COVID, corporate practices were blowing up, right? There was like so much corporate work. That was the year that we got special bonuses, raises, all of that. So the first years who came in, there wasn't a lot of litigation work. And even if you wanted to do litigation, the firm would be like, oh, but, you know, do you want to try corporate? We have a lot of work. And the litigators were like, oh, yeah, sure, I'll try it. So they do corporate work. And then come to 2023, and there's a recession in corporate work. And all of a sudden, they're like, oh, my God, I might be at risk of getting laid off. There's just like not enough work to go around. What about litigation? Litigation is increasing again, especially things like bankruptcy. Can I try that again? And firms are telling them, no, you're too expensive to try litigation. So even these people who wanted to start off in litigation, because they kind of trusted the firm to have their best interests at heart, now they're in this like catch-22 position where they can't do the work that they want to do, or at least not at the same seniority compensation, but they're also just not able to do the work that they can do because of market demand.
That's interesting. Say more about schools feeding students to the firms that are good for the schools.
Yeah, I had the same question. I want to go back to the career office. Yeah, what's going on there?
Yeah, so I think this is something that, especially at Harvard, Career Services always tries to usher you to participate in big law recruiting. And even if you don't want to, even if you came in being like, I'm 100% public interest, they will still encourage you to do big law recruiting. And part of that mindset, they're just like, oh, you know, it's only a week, all your friends are doing it. And after the summer, if you don't like it, then you don't have to go back. So it seems like a very easy thing to try and not much of a commitment, right? But even that is an opportunity cost, right? And how easy it is to get a job from a summer associate summer, it's sometimes hard to pass the ease of signing that offer letter up to then spend your 3L unemployed and trying to find a full-time job offer for like this public interest thing that you really wanted to do. And I think there's kind of a, at some point, these are very high achieving students who have worked hard all their life. And at some point they're like, you know what, I kind of do just want to like take the easier route and lean back a little bit. But you don't realize that it's because the inertia of big law recruiting is so strong that all other paths, like, you know, if you wanted to work at a mid-sized firm, I don't even know how you would begin trying to find out how. Career Services is not going to help you there. If you want to go to a boutique firm immediately after, if you want to start a solo practice, Career Services does not help you out there. So I think recognizing that, because they also want to tell prospective students, right, that, hey, our average salary of a grad is yay high. They have kind of an entrenched interest to get you to these big law jobs, but they aren't telling prospective students that that's why. And they certainly aren't telling the applicants, the like real life individuals who are going through recruiting, that they have this vested interest in the outcome. And you really think that they're being unbiased. Like, I was choosing between two firms, and I think one would have honestly been better for what I wanted to do. But I remember the career services counselor telling me, but don't you want that shiny name? You can always switch later. And I'm an immigrant. My parents aren't lawyers. And I was like, okay, I guess if you're saying so, like, I guess you're right. And looking back, I'm like, I mean, it turned out fine. I can't hate it because it turned out fine. But I also do think she didn't really understand my preferences and like my desires.
Yeah. We talk a lot all the time about how admissions is not really, like, if you talk to law school admissions, they're not on your side. Law school admissions, I mean, they want you to apply right now with whatever LSAT you might have. They don't care. I mean, it benefits them to be able to deny you. Mm-hmm. It also benefits them to admit you without a scholarship. Mm-hmm. So they're just like, apply right now, write whatever in your personal statement. Don't really prep for the LSAT. Just make sure that you apply right now. And they also say, oh, and you can do anything with a JD. They love talking about that. You know, they're going to show you the nonprofit, whatever, these clinics that they have, and they're all these different things. But then they also, like, the second you're there, they say, don't get locked into any one path, because most people do change their minds once they get to law school. We want you to be open-minded. And then they just beat you over the head with Big Law OCI journal, you know, just hammering you with all the things that are, again, in their interest, which is take a big, fancy, shiny name, big salary, so that we can report high Big Law placement statistics, and so that we can report high average salary. The median the mean salary, which of course is a lie.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are those the main motivators, do you think? The high salary and the Big Law placement numbers? Or is there other things like donation rates for people who go into Big Law, or
like particular connections with firms or something like that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think it is sometimes, especially at certain schools, a lot of firms try to participate in on-campus recruiting. And definitely during 1L year, you have a lot of Big Law firm sponsored receptions. And those are big things. They're coordinated with career services, essentially. So there's kind of this symbiotic relationship between Big Law recruiting and career services. They kind of want to scratch your back, you'll scratch mine, right? There is kind of a need for constant talent and a need to send your students to high-paying jobs. So it's a perfect symbiotic relationship that the students are really the ones getting shuffled amongst rather than having agency in the process. But they don't see that kind of symbiotic shuffling.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny as you say that. I'm going back to undergrad stuff, but I just remember when, I don't know how many years ago this was, but I was reading about how the undergrad institutions were pointing students who had financial aid needs to a hotline that was run by the the loan companies. Right. Oh. So you think you're going to get like you're saying, you're going to get advice, but the way you're describing it, it's like, oh, I'm going to go to career services. They're going to help me out. And it's like, no, no, they're not your attorney.
No,
they're someone else's. And you don't, but it's not presented that way. No. I mean, I don't know if it's that extreme, but you, this symbiotic relationship that you're describing, you start to see things a little differently. Or wait a sec. So how is this, how does everybody help each other in a way that's not helping you?
Yep. Yeah. And there's all these systems, I think, at each stage of the legal education process and then the legal industry careers, everyone is kind of trying to funnel money around in kind of a circle. And it's fine if you realize it and you're in the place during the cycle that you want to be at. But if you don't, then yeah, you're kind of the you're just at the whims of other people.
Wow. Okay. So keep in mind that other people have other interests at heart when they're trying to, quote, help you. Mm-hmm. Any other things you want people to think about who are like, hey, you know what? I'm going to go to law school and I'm going to go to Big Law. That's my path.
What kind of people do you think thrive there specifically?
So I think in Big Law specifically, if you are really detail oriented as a junior associate, they love that. Like, that is what they want you to be. They want you to be on call 24/7. They want you to be super detail oriented. They want you to catch the fact that that comma is not italicized. You know, like, everything that you learn in blue booking, that you learn in legal writing, that you learn to be like really anal about, big law firms love that. That's what creates a good associate in their mind. However, the rub is that those skills do not necessarily help you advance further at the firm. So there's a switching of standards, really, of when you're evaluated differently. And that starts being when you're a senior associate, when you're thinking about trying to go for partner. And I think the most insidious thing sometimes is that the current partners don't help you prepare for a promotion. They don't help you figure out what you need to do in order to get promoted successfully to partner, but also not be a partner that's dependent upon other partners for work. And there's not a lot of training or processes on how to do this. And the constant emphasis on just billing hours, it hides the fact that business development and having your own clients is the single most effective factor you can have in your big law career, but they're not going to help you do that. And it almost helps the existing partnership if you are beholden to them.
Of course.
But
no, yeah. They want it to be as flat as possible. They want to have as many associates billing hourly, working their asses off, totally disposable. We can replace you with just these hordes of new first year, second year associates whenever we need to. We can add more cannon fodder. And then, you know, like what, how do they benefit by having a new partner? That's just a new owner who's going to share in the profits of the firm. And really, you're only going to make partner when you have the ability to walk off with a whole bunch of business or the ability to bring in a whole bunch of business. Then they go, okay, cool. Yeah, you're a good, we want you to be part owner, because if not, you're going to go start your own firm somewhere or work for some, you know, take all this business to some other firm. I mean, it's just fairly straightforward, right? It's not like they hire you day one and they're okay, so we want to make sure that we build your career toward partnership in our firm. That's honestly the last thing that they would want, I would think.
Yeah, unless you luck out and work for a partner who does want to do that sponsorship and mentorship. And I think that's the nice thing, especially at MoFo, that I wound up working under a partner who really was the best at that, kind of ushering you through the entire process, really helping you understand the firm politics. Like, you know, Ben, you mentioned somehow your firm was okay with you making TikToks and content. And she helped me figure out how to navigate that process. She helped me figure out who to talk to. She massaged the relationships, did the introductions, helped me figure out my talking points for these people. And like, without her, I honestly don't know how I could have gotten as far as I did in being able to make my career the way that I wanted to. And that is just pure luck. That is pure luck that...
Do you think that that benefited her in some way, or was she just like super, super nice?
I think she is super, super nice. And she also probably did like the recruiting PR that having my content out there did. I think it was kind of a boon to recruiting for summer associate classes to know that, hey, this is a person who seems to be working at this firm, but also have time for other things in their life. So she was a little bit like, let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater. So she did think there was a baby in the whole situation.
Yeah, there's some, like, she's building her own little empire within the firm, right? Or she's increasing her power within the firm by bringing in somebody and trying to get them on that track.
Yeah. And she's very entrepreneurial. Like, you know, she built out her practice, which was a new practice at the time. I think she really has a different view of big law than some other partners have. And that's one thing I really, really appreciated about working with her. And then also prompted my thinking about, wow, why can't more big law partnerships be like this? What can we do to move this needle? Because I think it's better for all parties involved.
Entrepreneurship, I think, is something that would scare a lot of our students, LSAT students. You know, they're going into law school because they want a job. They want, you know, a lot of them that are going into big law, it's like, no, I want that $200,000 starting salary. I want someone else to pay me, do my own thing. Oh, God forbid. But they don't realize that if you don't kind of do your own thing, if you're not entrepreneurship, if you're not entrepreneurial, if you're not out there getting business somehow, creating an entirely new practice area like your boss did, or in some other way, like if you're not making it rain, then you're just not probably gonna keep advancing in the firm, which means you're probably gonna end up leaving the firm at some point and or having a fairly miserable existence at that firm. I don't know. Yeah. People have this fantasy about, oh no, if I just stay there and work really hard at the firm, then eventually I'll be a partner. And does not seem to be how it actually works.
Definitely not nowadays. And I think especially as big law firms do away more with lockstep partner compensation, that's been something that's happened. I mean, not even Cravath does lockstep anymore. The entire industry seems a bit more like finance, honestly. And I think that's where the tension comes, is you go into law because you want that stability. You do think, oh, I'll put my like 8 to 10 years and I'll get made partner. Someone will give me their work. And that's really not the reality of the industry anymore. So the sooner, and I was one of those people that when I graduated law school, I was like, I do not want to be in charge. I do not want to do anything that's even a little risk taking. I'm so risk averse. which is fine in the beginning. But I think it's good to be aware of the realities of the industry that you're in and to get comfortable with the fact that, yeah, maybe you don't want to take any risks now, but at some point in your life, you will maybe have to take some risks to advance in your career to make it the way you want it to, or you will want to take a risk and you should lean into that because someone's going to kick you out of the bird's nest at some point. Someone's going to make you take a risk, whether you want to or not.
Do you control that or not?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it almost sounds like you have to put your head down and do the hard work to win the good graces of the people who are above you at the firm. At the same time, you have to be savvy and starting to learn how to develop business. You can't just put your head in the sand and say, well, I'm the hardest worker here. And they're like, great, just keep doing that, right? Because you're gonna keep getting raises and then eventually be kicked out, right? Because you're not worth what you cost anymore.
Yeah.
It sounds like. That's what I'm hearing, I guess, but I don't know.
Yeah, you kind of have to dually manage your billable hours. And I think all of the emphasis on billable hours in our talks about like the legal industry actually does a disservice to what we think about is a lawyer, because yes, billable hours are a part of it, but only gets you so far. And you have to be responsible for these other things about like sales development, marketing, like taking control of your own career, finding new practice areas that you think you can develop that other people can't. You have to be doing these other things on top of your billable hours if you really want to have a career that you control and that is like fully yours. But all of our focus about billable hours and how much we work, I think that gets lost in translation.
I think this would horrify many of our big law bound students because they just think that, you know, they're so earnest, right? 4.0 undergrad, work their ass off to a 170 something on the LSAT. And it's like, oh, and they look at the billable hours thing and they go, oh, so you're telling me I have to work 60 hours a week so that I can bill 50 hours a week? No problem. I'm used to that. I can work 60 hours a week. No problem. But what you're saying is, yeah, you got to work 60 hours a week to bill 50. And then you've got to like try to do something because otherwise you're just going to burn out on that. They're just going to work you to the bone on that path.
Yeah, because they have no incentive to share their profits with you unless you bring in something yourself. They're going to park you as like a salaried counsel.
And as they keep giving you raises, as Ben was referring to, as they keep giving you raises, then your value to them becomes actually less and less because they keep thinking like, well, you know, I mean, you were worth more to us 5 years ago. You did the same amount of work, but we got to pay you a lot less. So, well, maybe, yeah, they just, how does that look? What do they actually just kick people out or what do they do?
It really depends on the firm, I think, and the practice group. Different firms position themselves differently. Part of it depends on whether you become a senior associate or of counsel who can manage your own work streams, right? Like, that's really important, being able to take care of mental load, even if you can't, you know, have your own clients, being able to take care of mental load and run your own matters is more helpful than just being able to follow directions. So on some level, it's like, okay, maybe you're like, I don't want to do any business development. I just don't want to do sales. That's fine. Then you still need to get good at management and delegation and kind of project management as skills, because that's what's going to keep you at the firm and in the good graces of the partners. You can't just bill hours and do what you're told to do for forever. That will definitely get you kicked out.
So of counsel, a partner can bring in the business and then just entirely hand it off to you because they know, okay, this person's got everything. They can figure it all out. They're just not bringing in the business.
Yes.
So got it.
Yes.
And the difference in compensation between that of counsel role and the partner role?
You know, I think it really depends because partners aren't really lockstep anymore. So I think sometimes partners don't make that much than of counsel at another firm. And sometimes probably of counsel at another firm makes more than junior partners elsewhere. It's just kind of all over the place. So there's like there's very little stability in the way that I think a lot of people who think about big law think there is stability.
So if you're saying that there's not this lockstep thing anymore, then instead of partners buying in at a fixed rate, the same as everyone else, they're buying in for wildly different amounts and
No. So I think the capital contribution is still the same, but your capital contribution is just your buy-in into the firm.
Yeah.
Right. You are a shareholder. Okay. But how they calculate compensation is not directly proportional to your capital contribution. How they calculate your compensation looks at, you know, how much business you brought in, how much business you worked on, you know, other factors, maybe like how much you helped other partners. It's like really a little bit more of a black box. And I
think negotiation skills are, sorry to cut you off, but like negotiation is going to matter a lot here, right? Which is something that some attorneys are going to be great at, but others are going to be abysmal at, right? Oh, yeah, sure, I'll take that. That sounds great.
If I'm understanding correctly, what you're talking about is nominally ownership. It's a type of ownership, but it's just not like ownership and you actually are equally entitled to the profits of the firm. You're an owner. You've bought in for something, but you're still going to get paid as a percentage of how much business you're bringing to the firm. That seems great for the senior partners who are like, oh yeah, you guys can come on this kind of a deal. This is a sweet. Oh no. Yeah. You're going to be a partner. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And in certain, I think sometimes when you go through big law recruiting, people throw around the term like eat what you kill. And there are some firms that are purely eat what you kill. And what it also means is that certain partners, when they, you know, let's say you're staffing a huge M&A and you need all these different practice groups to help participate. When you're staffing it with partners in the other groups, you might actually have to negotiate credit exchange in order for them to work on your deal. So you're kind of saying like, I will give you a little bit credit in this, but then you'll go to all the partners in, I don't know, say tax, and then be like, oh, but who will do it for the least amount of credit? Because I want to keep some for me. And this is actually happening at all these firms. And it's a level of ruthlessness. And I think, you know, just free market that we find kind of surprising for something as that has such like a gentleman's club facade as big law.
Yeah.
And the clients are aware of this, not aware of this, or they're just paying the bill.
You know, I feel like they're probably just paying the bill because I don't know if they care to scrutinize how the work is getting done in this way. Like they're paying one fee and how the firm divvies it up is kind of up to the firm.
Interesting. Nathan, did you have anything else that you wanted to ask about that?
Not about that specifically. We have tons of other things. I mean, we could talk all day. I don't know how much time you have, CC. Where can people follow you, though? I do want to make sure that you get all your channels out there.
Yeah. So I am on YouTube, Substack, Instagram, TikTok, of course, but I'm taking a little bit of a step back to work on my book and then also my website. And they're all pretty easy to find. It's just my name, CC Shia, everywhere. And you can just find me there.
CC Shia, C-E-C-E, Shia, X-I-E.
Yep.
Anything else, Ben, that you wanted to talk about? I know you did a bunch of readings.
Yeah. So I read your interview that was posted on Above the Law. Mm-hmm. And there's some great advice in here. And there's some things that stuck out to me. Here's one that I thought was kind of funny. You said even little things like whether the partner prefers track changes or a red line wasn't actually so little. And then you said, or arranging everyone in the CC by senior.
Yep. Wow.
Yeah.
So people care about that. They're like, hey, wait. I should have been higher up in the CC on that email.
I think sometimes it's honestly more for partners who want to understand the client side hierarchy, and they will reprimand you to be like, why didn't you put everyone in seniority order? So I know just looking at your email, who on the client side is of higher, you know, is like the boss versus like who is just like the analyst on something. So I think for them, it's like informational, but
I thought it was like personal offense
on the firm side.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe it's a little that too, but I don't think, you know, people are smart enough to know that they can't always just say what they actually mean. So they'll come up with all sorts of reasons why they need to you to do something. And that kind of is, that's kind of lawyering and like being an advocate.
That's funny. One thing that stuck out to me is you said that every time you were assigned to a matter, you would schedule a coffee or a call or a Zoom with some slightly more senior associate to just learn a lot about the partner. And you'd ask them all sorts of questions about how they're likely to work and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I just thought this is generally a good lesson for so many other things. And I think mm-hmm. that you were trying to say that as well. I feel like so many younger folks and just anyone these days, they want to text, right? They want to reach out digitally, which is of course how a lot of things start, but picking up the phone, trying to meet in person, these things just are like,
or on the phone scary. Or on Zoom.
Yeah.
But yeah, to like actually connect with somebody, it's just so much more information can get transmitted in such a short amount of time. The emails are great for people that you already know and for ongoing matters, but for brand new folks. Yeah. You say schedule a coffee or a call or a Zoom.
Yeah.
Not a long ass email chain.
Yeah. And if this, just from a purely efficiency standpoint too, my friend uses the dictation to text feature on phones. And I don't know if you've ever seen people use that in real life, but it's like really weird to witness. You're like watching someone just be like, hi, period, tell them. And I really was like, who the hell is using this? This is so silly. But my friend was like, this is actually way more efficient and faster than typing. And I was like, well, no, I'm a really fast typer. Like, let's try. So we actually did a test where we competed against each other. He said this thing and I typed it and it was faster. So purely from like an efficiency standpoint, too, a call will relay so much more information in a shorter amount of time than any text chain will. And then you'll also have that extra time where you can build rapport, because we do tend to build rapport more in person. Like, human beings love faces. If I've learned anything from social media, it's that people like looking at faces in a weird way. Like, if you start a video with your face, people are way more likely to continue watching the video than without your face, because we are just drawn to faces as humans. Hmm.
Well, and also there's so many random little things that get conveyed, right? Like, you're talking to them and someone slips a comment like, oh, but I have to go to Dallas next week mm-hmm. or something. You're like, oh, why are you going to Dallas? And then you just learn something about whatever that would never get shared, right?
Yeah.
Via a formal or even non-formal just text, because it's just so limiting. Anyways, when I read that, I just wanted people to hear. We've mentioned it on the show before, but we want people to reach out to attorneys now and just do these kind of things. Just grab coffee, talk on the phone, maybe just hop on Zoom and say, hey, can I just talk to you briefly about your practice and what you do, and maybe just learn a little bit. I'm trying to decide whether I want to go into this field, as opposed to going to law school, spending 3 years of their life, thousands of dollars, even if they get a scholarship, to then discover that no.
When you were, you were doing your whole social thing, or you were creating content while you were in the firm, but mm-hmm. that I'm sure made people reach out to you.
Yes.
And that might have been too much, where you like couldn't actually even talk to all the people who wanted to talk to you. But what about before that? Were you willing to help out people who reached out, or did people even ever reach out?
Honestly, I mean, before I had more of a public persona, I would have been more likely to take these calls, right? And I think sometimes this is a problem where people see someone online or who seems to be like big in some way, and then they try to reach out to them. And that's fine. Everyone should shoot their shot. But I actually do think it is way more, you have a higher ROI for someone who isn't as in the public eye and who like doesn't get these requests for conversations as much. And you should honestly like look at maybe the person that you want to talk to, someone in their practice group, someone like related to them, someone who used to work with them. And that is a much better way to potentially get someone on the phone and to have like a real honest conversation about them, right? I also think in general, like lawyers, especially those who work in litigation, you're really, really concerned about what you put in writing. So you are much more likely to say things that are much more candid in person, or like, through voice than through typing.
Yeah. I think that people need to learn that they should reach out to people and ask them those questions. And yeah, probably don't start with famous people, or, you know, because if you reach out to somebody who's not a, you know, they are a law firm associate, but they are not an influencer of any sort or content creator or famous in any way, you reach out to that person. Well, now they feel good about, oh, wow, somebody's interested in me. Somebody wants to know about my story. And I think that those folks are going to be way more likely to say yes than
reaching out to you. And I do think, you know, I always tell people you should have like at least an idea of like 5 practice areas that you want to look into before you go to law school, before you apply, because if you don't have that 5, you won't have enough time to explore, I don't know, the hundreds and hundreds of real practice areas that probably exist and all the different employer types. I do think, I know Ben and Nate, like you guys aren't practicing, but I firmly believe that most people could find a career as a lawyer that is right for them and makes them like pretty happy. The problem is maybe sometimes you just like don't get the opportunity to get there, but there are like more entrepreneurial practices. There are more creative ones. Like it's a big world out there. And the bad part is that it's just hard to find fit in a big world.
You mentioned shortly after this that you wanted to give people a roadmap to learn what they needed to learn in order to thrive in whatever legal setting they found themselves in. Mm-hmm. What does that rough roadmap look like? Is that even something we can describe here? Or is that the book?
I think I'll definitely go into it in the book, but part of it is just knowing that you have to understand who you're working with. It's not just about sitting at your desk and knowing the law. That will only get you so far. And I think learning the players at your firm, learning the politics, unfortunately, of the firm are so helpful to advancing your career. But there's almost an innate aversion to doing things like talking to others and like learning about the firm structure and learning firm politics. It feels like icky in some way, or like internally networking with other practice groups or other partners. It just feels like weird and like something you shouldn't have to do when your work should speak for itself. But the reality of the situation is that's not how any workplace works. And it's not how law works. You could write the most beautiful brief, but if you don't have the right advocates, if you don't have the right sponsors and the right footprint within a firm, you can only get so far. So being aware of politics being a necessary evil of any organization, I think, is really, really important. And I, you know, you can't ask every partner immediately to speak with you. So I always say start with their assistants. I feel like their assistants are usually so knowledgeable. They know everything about the partners. They worked with them for years. They know how to do everything. And, you know, just like be nice to them, like give them, bring them coffee. I watched Partner Track and there's a lot about the show that I didn't love. But one thing that I thought was really, really accurate was how Ingrid, this associate, in order to get FaceTime with this partner that she works with, she'll bring coffee to his assistant and like try to figure out how to get on his calendar. Because sometimes like you will never get on the partner's calendar. But you know who can help you? The assistant. So being aware of these like sideway entries to figuring out the politics, I think, is really, really important.
So the roadmap is being aware of the fact that you need to go out and get information about the partners, about, I guess, any attorneys that you have to work with.
Yeah. Yeah. And then also being aware of who can help you, who has the power to help you, because even sometimes you can be really close with someone who wants to help you, but they don't necessarily have the power to help you, or they might only know about their narrow experience of what it takes to get promoted to partner. And you have to find out from someone else that, oh, there was actually this like huge roadblock. Like I know one firm, they require unanimous approval for promotion to partnership. And she found out that one partner just wasn't going to retire and would probably always vote no to her because he wants to stay on. And that's something that everyone else in the group was surprised by. She honestly, unless she was so entrepreneurial and investigative, she would have just stayed on and kept on being like, why am I never getting promoted? So there's like these little things. You have to be a lot more of a detective than I think you might think you need to be. You're like, oh, I'm just a lawyer. No, you have to be a detective too.
And a politician, it sounds like.
And a politician, yeah. There's a lot more skills to it than just... But of course, if you don't want to work in that setting, right, you can take yourself out of it and, like, use your other skills. Maybe it's marketing. Maybe it's sales. Maybe... There's just, like, so many ways to do it that if you are like, I hate politicking, you don't have to do it. But it's better to know that you have to do it than to be surprised that you have to do it and know that that's why your career isn't where you want it to be.
Okay. Seems like a good place to leave it. Ben, anything else?
No, thanks so much for coming on, CC. I think this will be really interesting for a lot of people, whether or not they're interested in big law. It's just, you know, it's a world that, like you said, we're all kind of interested in. In the fiction way, but now we have a chance to look at it through nonfiction lens, which is great.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me on and letting me rant about my favorite subject right now, which is law firms.
I hope you'll come back on to promote Big Bad Law when the time comes.
Oh, you can count on it. I'll put you on the podcast list.
All right, Ben, I'm glad that this is buried at the bottom of the show. We have a quick note from LSAC about Control F. You probably don't want to read this whole thing, or do we?
I'll just read little bits and pieces of it here. So, this is happening for the August 2023 LSAT. So just around the corner, due to enhanced security measures. That's interesting alone. I don't know what security measures they're worried about. Keyboard commands such as Control F will no longer be available while taking the LSAT. We are introducing an alternative that will provide similar functionality to Control F as described below. This change will affect all LSAT test takers regardless of whether they're testing remotely or in person at a Prometric test center. And all they're doing is they're taking away the Control F and they're adding a search bar at the top of the test where you can search for words on the page, just like you would with Control F.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess I get the security measures thing, right? Like Control F and Control C are similar commands. So Control C has been disabled previously, but I think I can see how somebody might've rearranged their keyboard to make Control F be copy.
Oh, maybe so. Yeah, I was just curious what security problems they had run into. Yeah. I was just trying to imagine.
That's off the top of my head. But I mean, I figure must be what they're doing is that they like, nah, we don't want you to have keyboard commands pretty much at all. So they're taking that away. They're giving you a search box instead. The search box is going to be at the top of the screen. It's never going to move. You can't get rid of it. You don't need to use it. And we don't really teach people to use it. It could be interesting to search on the reading comp. You could search for periods, right? Search for period space, and it'll give you a divider, like a harder divider between sentences. And that might help some people. It especially might help people with learning differences, but we do not teach any techniques that require the use of Control F anyway. So, I mean, that's just not something that we recommend for most people. I personally would never do the search for period space because why? I'm reading the sentence. I'm paying attention. There's a period there. I'm going to stop.
If you want to, and we're going to be rolling this out in the demon soon just to mirror the actual test. But yeah, not a lot of news here other than that.
Yeah, you've got that already as a development item, and it'll happen at some point on all of the practice tests in LSATdemon.com. But really nothing to worry about. It's not. Like, don't pay too much attention to this. You know, I worry that people are going to get this email and they're going to then think that they need to use this search feature that they had
never. Oh, I never used Control F before. Well, I guess everybody is. They made this new search box just for it.
Yeah. It's really not something that we teach. You do not need to do this. Disregard, basically. If you haven't already been using Control F, just disregard the search box that they're going to have at the top of the screen.
Be LSAT famous. Please ask questions or share news with us at thinkinglsat.com. Questions about the LSAT demon? Email help@lsatdemon.com. Check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 414 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing ya. Don't pay for law school.